loudest weekend of the year is back. Louder Than Life in Louisville, Kentucky with Slayer, Slipknot, Motley Crue, Korn, Judas Priest, Disturbed, Five Finger Death Punch, Breaking Benjamin, Evanescence, Falling in Reverse, The Offspring, and so many more. September 26th through 29th in Louisville, Kentucky. Passes on sale now at louderthanlifefestival.com.
Don't go to sleep, motherfucker. Don't go to sleep.
And do me a favor. Don't disturb my friend. He's dead tired.
Well, what the hell are you saying, Doss? You bruised half your body sleeping.
I sleep pretty hard.
Welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories.
Hey, it's Brian.
And hey, it's Murdoch. Welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories, everyone.
You can always get involved. It's wearethestoryguys@gmail.com. We often reiterate that this show is about a rumor and innuendo, but it's also about rumor and innuendo around your favorite bands and your favorite songs. So often we end up deep diving on musical acts, but sometimes it's about the tunes. And like, for instance, not that long ago, episode 160, we talked about songs versus muses. That was like songs that were inspired by particular women. I thought that was fun.
Yeah.
When I went through the letters this week, I found a similar pile of perusals, right? But this time, it's songs about a particular place. So again, wearethestoryguys@gmail.com. If you want to write the show like Daryl did, Daryl said this: I have definitely heard it said more than once that GNR's Paradise City is about Louisville, Kentucky. Is there any truth to that? Seems like you guys are the best possible pair to ask. Have you ever heard that, Murdoch?
Yeah, I have.
You have?
And I can't remember. I remember like it coming up and I was like, what? Huh? For real? And then it was like, oh yeah, that's right. So him and Izzy lived in Indiana. So Louisville would be like a pretty somewhat bigger city that I guess they would go to, but there's Evansville, Fort Wayne, Chicago. There's all these other cities.
Right.
But that was first time I'd heard it.
I think I just assumed it was about LA because I just assume all their songs are about LA.
Yeah, I don't know if you ever, how many times you've watched the Live at the Ritz 1988 Guns N' Roses concert that they put on MTV.
Not as many as you, I'm sure.
Because he explains that like when Izzy had come to LA, and they were in LA, and some guy, this is the story he told, and it's just like, you know, it's like a story that Paul Stanley or anybody else would tell on stage. But he said there was a little old man and he goes, "You know who you are." And so the song was always about LA.
but that's Welcome to the Jungle. Okay.
Totally.
Okay. Yeah. But Paradise City could be about somewhere else.
About,
So why Louisville? What leads anybody to think that? Now, you sort of pointed to this a little bit that, yeah, he's from, spoiler alert, from Indiana. There is a interview from Hit Parader circa 88. Here's the quote.
Hit Parader! I just want to say Hit Parader out loud because I haven't done that in quite a while.
Were you a big fan of Hit Parader?
Fuck yeah. I had a subscription to Hit Parader.
For like how long?
A while. and Metal Edge.
Oh, hell yeah.
Metal Edge
is still a website that doesn't get updated near as often as I would like, but it exists. So Axl Rose does this Hip Parader magazine interview in 1988. The quote is, "The verses are more about being in the jungle," so that's like being in LA, "but then the chorus is like being back in the Midwest or somewhere."
Daryl that wrote the letter, if you don't know, there is a controversy about whether Louisville's actually a southern city or a Midwestern
city. This is like a real thing. People like get really passionate about this argument.
Yeah. And as someone that where I grew up with, like, this is not a southern city. Like,
right. If you're from the south, you don't think this is a southern city. If you're from the north, it feels way more southern than where you're from. And it's not really Midwest because we don't say pop. So, you know, it's just a city without an identity. And so for him to say the Midwest, I mean, I don't know. Is that a signifier of Louisville? When you start looking for evidence of any of this, you can end up pretty quickly in message board hell and Reddit thread hell. And here's a highlight that I found. John H. Brownstone, who does claim to be from Louisville, Kentucky. John, shouts if you're listening.
Yo.
He says in this thread, "It's about Louisville, Kentucky. Axel and Izzy used to drive down from Lafayette to buy party supplies." So this is what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. But there's three interstates here. There's lots of party supplies. So off the dome, let me say Axel is from the middle of Indiana. He's from Lafayette.
Yes, this is worth pointing out. I'm glad you're pointing this out.
3 hours from Louisville, so north of there. So while I could say that this might have been a close metro area when he was a kid and needed alcohol, it'd been closer to go to Indy, or even, you know, not that far to go to Chicago.
Yeah, he'd been way closer to Indy, probably like an hour from Indy and maybe 2 hours from Chicago. So it doesn't make sense that he'd be coming here. And now you bring up Indianapolis, which is interesting because I did dig up and find that the Indy Star ran a piece in 2021 addressing this same type of rumor. But in their telling, this song is not about Louisville or even Indianapolis, but it's about Bloomington, Indiana, which is where the University of Indiana is, of course. Indiana University, IU, Bobby Knight, all that stuff. And that sits in between Louisville and Indy, but it's like at a weird angle. It's not directly in between the two. It's like 2 hours from Louisville and an hour from Indy.
The article asks, is this the southern Indiana city of 85,000 in the heartland of America really the ultimate utopia for an 80s rock star?
Well written, whoever wrote that.
Because that's what some people have speculated for years, suggesting that Guns N' Roses' song Paradise City is about Bloomington, all because Lafayette natives, Axl and Izzy, were rumored to take road trips to IU, where the grass is green and the girls are pretty.
So I was thinking about when I've been to Bloomington, Indiana, and maybe one of the only times is with you.
They went to see Mark Maron?
We went to see Mark Maron at the amazing... So Bloomington has an amazing comedy scene, an amazing comedy festival called the Limestone Comedy Festival. But I think this was unrelated. I think this was just the Comedy Attic, which is very literally an attic, tiny comedy club. Every time I'm in a comedy club of any repute, I'm like, I forget how small comedy clubs are because I'm used to rock shows where you're like, oh, look at this small club. It fits 250 people. And you're like, look at this cool, intimate comedy club. It fits 100 people and we're all sitting on each other's lap. So really, it fits 50 people. This is a fire hazard. But it was a great night. But I do remember the drive sucks because there's no interstate. You were talking about this town having interstates.
Yeah.
There's no interstates into Bloomington. You go 65, and then you jump off of 65, and you just drive on two-lane highways for like an hour.
And this Bloomington rumor gets attributed to the sportscaster in Indy. His name is Jake Query. And when you see this pop up, it often gets identified that Jake is a friend of Axel's.
Okay, I heard this too, but apparently Jake says this is an urban legend that originated at North Central High School. And he says that it was fueled partly because there was this natural rivalry between Purdue, which again, we're like getting real deep into like geography and where things are in a state. So shouts to any Indiana listeners. But Purdue, West Lafayette, which is up above Indianapolis, and then the University of Indiana, which is in Bloomington, which is down there below. So here's the quote from Jake. Quote, somehow we convinced ourselves of this, that people from Purdue would come to IU to party because it was a better looking campus with better looking girls. And we would joke, yeah, you know, it's like Paradise City when Izzy and Axel wrote that Bloomington was Paradise City because they're from Lafayette. So they know what Paradise City would be. And it's definitely not Lafayette. It's Bloomington.
The truth of the matter is that Jake does not know Axel personally, and he says that he thinks the only reason this story gets told about it being Bloomington is because he told this dumb tale about his high school on a radio show once a decade ago, and it morphed into a fact.
Okay, so even the guy who supposedly started this rumor and knows Axel says that's not true. So probably not Bloomington. Probably not Louisville. Where else is up for debate? Where else can Paradise City be?
Well, if we go backwards to Lafayette itself, that's like Axel pining for life in his hometown.
But except Axel didn't like life in his hometown, did he? I mean,
no. There was a Rolling Stone interview. It was like 87 or 88. And like for me reading it, it was really interesting reading where he took a bottle of Jack Daniels and threw it across a room and broke a mirror and said, mood swing.
Oh, geez. Like he did or his dad did?
He did himself, just like he's like, is like the band in the rehearsal space or whatever. And he's just like, mood swing, and just like threw something almost as if it was like a funny thing. And I didn't understand the context of it or anything at the time. But yes, to your point, no. He did not enjoy growing up in
Lafayette. Life was tough for him, man. You know, he was in and out of jail. We talked about him a little bit on the show before. Obviously, it's freaking Axl Rose, but this is not something you would necessarily pine for.
No, there is a Paradise, Indiana, just like there's a Sugar Tit, Indiana.
But there's a Paradise, Indiana.
Right. But it's 3.5 hours away from Lafayette, and it's an unincorporated township, meaning mail going there is addressed to Newburgh, Indiana, which is technically where Leif, our producer, teaches school,
And we
pieced it all together into a triangle. Look at that.
So I know. So I reached out to Leif. When I got to this point in the research, I was like, oh, holy shit. Paradise is Newberg. And he says, dude, no one calls it Paradise. It's just Newberg.
So where do we land on this, you know, this letter from Daryl? Okay,
this is a great question. So I think that there was no specific city in mind. And part of this is because Axel says, hey, it's about the Midwest. It's about pining for the simpler time or whatever, right? He doesn't really talk about a certain place. But here's the other reason I think that. Slash is on the record as saying that the band wrote this song.
I think I've heard
this. Okay, so yeah. Back of a rental van. And they're sitting around drinking, messing around with acoustic guitars. And this is like, if you've ever been a musician, ever played with people, ever even played an acoustic guitar, you've probably had this experience. You're sitting around, you know, and there starts to be a little jam session, and someone starts playing a riff. In this case, it's freaking Slash. And then the other players start strumming along, and then in this case, it's, you know, happens to be Duff and Izzy. And then the singer starts humming, and the singer starts trying out phrases. So the way Slash tells this story, Axel tries out the phrase, take me down to the Paradise City. And Slash, while playing this sweet riff, answers back with, where the grass is green and the girls are pretty. And the story is that they write the rest of the song as a group by throwing the lines back and forth at each other. So if that's true, this song isn't really written with a particular place in mind at all.
Right. I will say that I've heard that Slash tried to make the second line where the girls are fat and they've got big, you know. I'm just not going to make it worse by continuing to say that. But Slash just like wanting to get rid of Sweet Child of Mine because he thought it sucked, he was outvoted.
Yeah, it's a good thing they outvote Slash, you know? He's just a kin. So maybe Paradise City isn't really about anywhere. But the bigger controversy with this song has absolutely nothing to do with where it's about. It's wrapped up in the guitar riffs. Do you know the song Lost in the City?
Yeah, take me down to the way back home. I lost all my money, but now I'm all alone.
Yeah,
City Boy
stole my car. Is that how it goes? Yeah.
Yeah. That's that.
It's definitely got some similarities.
But it's not the same song, but it's hard not to notice the similarities, especially because Axel's always said that Hanoi Rocks and Razzle always were an influence on them.
Oh, yeah.
Lost in the City's 84, uh-huh. Paradise City's 87. And so none of this is lost on Hanoi's Andy McCoy. And of course, by 87, Razzle's dead. Uh-huh. The band's done. Uh-huh. And there's nothing really much to litigate. And if you don't know about that drama, episode 135 will get you there. That's Vince Neil versus Hanoi Rocks, episode 135. And you'll be caught up to that conversation.
Hanoi Rocks, Lost in the City is worth listening to if you do not know that song, because there is a distinct moment where you go, oh! Like it's just a brief moment, but you're definitely like, okay, he was thinking about this when they were in. When you hear the story about them riffing in the back of the van with guitars, guys who were probably driving around listening to their favorite records on as they were playing music, it definitely adds up to me that, you know, you have a particle of a song in your head and you sort of use it as part of the riff, and then it becomes its own thing. So no, I don't think they stole it, but I definitely think it was influenced. Okay, we've established Paradise City. It was a drunken songwriting exercise, not specifically meant to be about anywhere. So let's go to another letter. You good for this?
Next letter.
Thank you. Again, we are thestoryguys@gmail.com. Cliffy, thanks for writing the show, man. Boys, love the show. What do you know about Huey Lewis's song, The Heart of Rock and Roll? He's opening a Broadway play by that title next month, and it got me thinking about it again and how he name drops a ton of cities. I grew up around Raleigh, North Carolina, and I could have sworn that he said Raleigh at the end of the song. Like he says, and Raleigh too.
Raleigh too.
But when I listen to this song on CD or streaming, because I have an old copy of it, it is not there. Did I make this up? I am positive he says Raleigh. But I also have done a lot of recreational drugs. Help me out here. Keep telling stories, Cliffy.
I concur. Look, here's the thing about Huey Lewis and the news is that whether you're a Gen Xer or younger, whoever, and you've ever like turned your nose up to his soundtrack million selling stuff or whatever, those guys were workers, man. Those guys were a working band. They worked their asses off to get to the point where they had, where they were, where eventually they got to release Sports and had however many singles off that.
And I'm thankful to that band. I'm thankful to that band because they gave us the very first episode of this show. This was the whole premise of this show was built on the story about the Ghostbusters theme song.
That litigation also went along for 170 years. So,
well, speaking of many years, do you know what's going on with him now for the last 5 or 6 years? Have you heard about this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He has Meniere's disease. Yeah.
Oh, my God, dude.
Yeah. So he has the thing that Ryan Adams has, and then another personal friend of mine has. The personal friend of mine at night has to wear sunglasses like Corey Hart because everything is a unbelievable migraine headache. The sensory, visual, hearing, everything is difficult.
It's
so
awful.
What's happened to him is it's like he can't. For Ryan Adams, you would have trouble hearing, but for Huey Lewis, he's having difficulty being able to sing at all.
Which is heartbreaking. Like, this all happens in 2018. It comes on very suddenly. He's at a private show in Dallas backstage, and he starts to hear this weird sound, and he's like asking everybody around him, hey, what is that noise? And it's just this coming on. And he ends up getting diagnosed with that. It's awful stuff. But in the years before all that, a friend's son-in-law who worked in theater had approached him about turning his catalog into a jukebox musical, which is not an idea I had thought of. But when you say it to me, a Huey Lewis jukebox musical, I'd be like, hell yes. Like, all those songs are perfect to be turned into some cheesy Broadway stuff.
Do you believe in love?
Ooh. Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely perfect.
And I Want a New Drug is so cheesy. It's like a song that you would put in a musical about wanting to do drugs. Versus like a song like Heroin by the Velvet Underground, which legitimately feels like a song that was written in or around by and influenced by it. Right.
Yeah, that's funny. I'm surprised, as you've probably heard my story before about Total Eclipse of the Heart being used as an anti-drug anthem at my college orientation. I do feel like the next step was I Want a New Drug. Maybe the year before they had used that and they needed something new, because that's funny. But Huey, when he gets pitched this idea, he doesn't understand how his songs could connect, right? So he's thinking like, from a storyline point of view, I don't know how you would just take my random songs and use them. But eventually something starts to come together, and then when he gets his diagnosis, now he has no other distractions. He literally can't tour with the band. So they launch it in his hometown of San Diego and then spend a good chunk of the next 5 years getting ready to go to Broadway, and that's happening. It's been green-lighted. It goes, I think, in April on Broadway. It's called The Heart of Rock and Roll. But do know this, couple things. It does not have Huey in it. He's just involved in launching it. I guess, I don't know if he's producing it, but he's involved in some way. And it's not about Huey. It's just a rom-com that uses Huey Lewis tunes.
Right. So let's talk about the tunes, right? So Huey Lewis and the News, this band that comes out of the joining of members of two rival San Diego bands. I don't know if anybody knew this from the 70s. One was playing tunes for Elvis Costello, and the other one was backing up Van Morrison. So neither one of these groups of guys were backing up Winger. Or that's a terrible thing. Winger had great backup people. I don't know.
They were hanging out with some legends. I mean, Van Morrison and Elvis Costello, two of the biggest legends from the 70s in rock and roll period. Yeah.
One was playing tunes for Elvis, the other playing songs for Van Morrison. Different members come together in 79, and they record under the name, for real, American Express. They get a record deal and then have to change that name. Guess why? And then Huey Lewis and the News is born.
So it takes a few years. You already mentioned this. But eventually they put out this album called Sports, and it is a monster hit. Four singles from that album go top 10 on the Billboard Hot 100. We've mentioned some of them. Heart and Soul, that goes 8. Want a New Drug, Heart of Rock and Roll, and If This Is It, all go number 6. And then the album itself sells 10 million copies in the U.S. alone, and it's pretty damn good. I gotta say, still pretty damn good. What do you have a favorite song on Sports?
Heart and Soul is my favorite.
That is really easy. Good. Really good. And then I like Walking on a Thin Line. And if you know Tattoo, which I believe is actually not on Sports, I think it's on the album before, also great if you just want to go dive into Huey Lewis later. But back to Heart of Rock and Roll. This was a hit. This was one of the number 6 songs in the country for a while. And what was the actual history of this tune?
So the two things make it really big. And one is MTV.
Sure.
So Huey Lewis is absolutely leverages MTV, or vice versa.
And he's good looking. Right? I mean,
yeah. Yeah, and he's just kind of built for the 80s, and he's got soundtrack songs, and so it works. So they tour in a van after that second album. Do You Believe in Love was a hit, but remember, this is when albums came out quickly. There are record label delays getting sports out, so just to keep momentum, they keep on the road in the van, and they just play clubs. So they're experiencing the crowds and the fans up close and personal, and they keep hearing rumors while they're touring that Cleveland is especially rowdy, and the music scene's supposed to be spectacular. But what are these guys from San Diego? They don't believe the hype.
Yeah, and then they play a club in Cleveland, and they start to believe the hype.
They get done playing a show there. It's supposedly, Huey says the band, the heart of rock and roll is, in fact, here in Cleveland. And that is going to be the hook of the song. But really? At some point, they realize it's a little more universal if they change it to Still Beating. And then he mentions Cleveland at the end, with is crazy that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is now in Cleveland.
And so, yeah, we should talk about that. We should talk about that connection in a second. But this then becomes retrofitted as a way to mention a bunch of cities in the country, right? They can't just say the heart of rock and roll is in Cleveland. They got, you know, so the verses have other cities. So here are the lyrics. New York and L.A., they show up really early, which makes sense, right? They're the two biggest cities in the country. And then he gets into sort of running through the country. So now the old boy may barely be breathing, but the heart of rock and roll, the heart of rock and roll is still beating. And then here's a list in the third verse. D.C., San Antonio, and the Liberty Town, Boston and Baton Rouge, Tulsa, Austin, Oklahoma City, Seattle, San Francisco, too. Everywhere there's music, real live music, real bands, live music, with a million styles. But it's still. I love that you're loving this. Take us home.
It's still the same old rock and roll music that really drives them wild.
This is going to be so good on Broadway. Like, this is written for Broadway. And then at the end, after that line, he yells, "In Cleveland, Detroit, oh, heart of rock and roll." But I'm telling you, there's no mention of Raleigh.
There's no Raleigh. But there is something.
And what?
This is fun because now we get to talk about something you and I know about, and remember that some people might not know, would be the fact that radio at one point, for some of you may not know this at all, radio used to be cool. And when radio was cool and a key to success in 1983, sometimes you could cut multiple versions of a song to appeal to certain
regions. So you're telling me this song has been cut with different cities inserted into it?
So instead of like, "Hey, this is Huey Lewis, you're listening to WLOR in Cleveland," like, no, the team working Huey songs think that it wouldn't hurt to have versions of this song that mention other cities, because the more cities you freaking name, the easier it'll be to get airplay in those places. Because let me tell you something, brother, everybody that's listening here, if you ever put a guitar on and get on stage in any city with no talent and say, "What's going on?" blank, insert name city, people cheer. It doesn't matter. Like, you could be dressed up in something awful. They'll be like, "Well, we like our city a whole lot." But yes, Cliffy, Raleigh was one of those cities. So you were on recreational drugs, possibly, but you did hear it correctly, for sure. It happened.
Unfreaking believable. Thank you for digging that up. Now, okay.
It's true.
I have this follow-up question, and you mentioned this, about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame being in Cleveland. Does this song, or Cleveland's reputation at all, have anything to do with why the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame ends up there?
Well, yes and no, maybe. So sports is 83. That song is a hit in 84. And the Hall of Fame Foundation is 83, okay. April of 83.
Okay.
But they don't get a location chosen until 1986.
So why would this rumor have started with Huey ever that Cleveland was really badass when it came to rock and roll, besides just like the local music scene?
The Drew Carey Show, didn't they have a thing that said Cleveland rocks? in it too?
Well, there's Alan Freed, and I think that helps, right?
Oh, because you go into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, there's an Ohio room, and Alan Freed's picture is like Nick Trent. If Trent Reznor's thing is on one side and Alan Freed's on the other, because they're both Cleveland guys.
I like that those two guys are the both sides of the coin. So he is, if I mean, we've talked about Alan Freed on the show. I think on the Tommy James episode, he comes up because he is definitely involved with Morris Levy and the mob. Morris Levy heavily uses Alan Freed, but Alan Freed gets a lot of credit, even though he was an ass hat, for a couple of things. One is birthing the term rock and roll. Like, he is the guy who gets credited for doing that. And that happens in Ohio. So that makes sense, I guess. And then the idea of rock concerts is something he starts to propagate by bringing these acts he's playing on the air into Cleveland. And so that was pretty powerful. Plus, we have talked, I believe, about WMMS, which is a big tastemaker in Ohio, and specifically for Springsteen. Springsteen grows a huge fan base in Ohio because of WMMS playing him early. We talk about that, I think, on the New Year's Eve episode from a couple years ago, where we talk about Bruce's New Year's Eve show. But anyway, all that to say, I think it's a combination of the presence of WJW and WMMS and Alan Freed that gives it some of that. But ultimately, and I did look this up,
Cleveland put up a bunch of $65 million.
Yeah, money talks, baby. I mean, Cleveland realized this was something they could cash in on, right? It's like in our town, somebody figured out like 10 years ago, what if bourbon became a thing again, right? And that's really helped the city over the last decade or two, reinvigorating the interest in bourbon and then tying it back to our city. Kudos to the people who have done that. And it was similar, I think, in the early 80s. As all of a sudden Cleveland was like, ooh, what if we gave people a reason to come to Cleveland as opposed to run from Cleveland? And, you know, they spent a lot of money to make it happen.
For that first group in 85, this is a fun fact for no one, probably but you, Brian. The first inductees in 85, they had a concert.
Okay.
But they didn't have a rock hall yet. And my sister got to go to that frickin' concert.
Really? Who played?
Jerry Lee Lewis. Chuck Berry was injured in a car accident, so he didn't play.
Why did she get to go?
She knew Clarence Clemens.
Oh, that's right. I forget this about your sister. Can we talk about your sister knowing Clarence Clemens? This is a whole thing.
I guess. Yeah. I mean, that's how she got that invite.
Unbelievable. It's one of the largest rock and roll music festivals in the country, and we've got your tickets. Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories is sending you back. We're sending you again to Louder Than Life Music Festival, and we want you to have plenty of time to plan. So as they drop the lineup, we're dropping wristbands. They could be yours, and all you have to do is send us an email. It's wearethestoryguys@gmail.com. That's simple. Send us the email and tell us your best, favorite, funniest, weirdest, I don't know, just tell us something about you at a music festival, because we tell stories on this podcast. We're about telling stories, so keep telling stories, and in the meantime, grab yourself some wristbands to Louder Than Life 2024, 4 days of music in Louisville, Kentucky. Lineup is huge. Check it out in the show notes. Get ready to rock out with us. Murdoch and I will be there. We'll probably see you. We just need you to win these wristbands, so go ahead. Take care of it. Send us an email. wearethestoryguys@gmail.com. Now, back to the show. Do we have time for another city-related question?
Yeah, let's do another one.
Okay, so this one is coincidentally also about Ohio, and it comes from a woman named Kim. Hey guys, while I am ashamed to admit it, because of my age and my parents' political leanings during my childhood, for a large chunk of my life, I knew the song My City Is Gone by The Pretenders as the theme song to the Rush Limbaugh Show.
It's so true.
When I moved to Ohio as an adult, imagine my surprise when people kept referring to the Ohio song and I had to hide why I knew it. How did Rush ever get the band to sign off on ruining that song for an entire generation? Thanks for not judging me. Keep telling those stories, Kim.
First, I don't know the exact answer on why they did this. I have a confession to make. A long time ago, 30 years ago, I remember seeing him on TV and realizing that he felt very progressive libertarian and didn't feel like he was a very right or left person. And I purchased a Rush Limbaugh book and read it. I sure did. I might have been 19.
Okay, I bought a Glenn Beck book early in Glenn Beck's career did the same thing.
Oh my gosh. That's like,
but
come on.
Hey, listen, I didn't grow up with a gas station owning dad who should have taught me better.
Yeah, but he didn't teach me.
He didn't teach you anything. You're right. He didn't teach you.
No, he didn't teach me anything. Nothing at all.
Okay.
Nothing.
So I also have this. I had this exact same experience that Kim had. I heard my dad listening to Rush Limbaugh, and thought that's when I heard that song later. And I mean, I claim Learning to Crawl is one of my favorite albums of all time now, but I had to unlearn the association with the first 34 seconds. And we should remind folks, if you don't know this song off the top of your head, it is excellent radio bumper music because it has an amazing walking bass line intro in it.
Right. We've talked some about Chrissy Hynde on this show before because The Pretenders really was a vehicle for
it's for her. So for those who associate some of the later radio ballads with this band, which shout to I'll Stand By You still holds up, it's likely forgotten that Chrissy Hynde comes out of the same scene as the Sex Pistols and the Damned. Like, she spends years trying to put a band together around her, and it keeps failing. Fun side note, one of these failed versions of the band for her was called Mike, M-I-K-E, Hunt, H-U-N-T's, Dishonorable Discharge. So she was, let's just say, not very radio friendly.
No. NSFW. The list of people she plays with and tries to make bands with is totally impressive.
It's amazing,
Sid Vicious, not for the musicality, but just for the namesake.
Just for that,
Mick Jones, for sure, involved in the early versions of things. But when she finally gets a record guy to give her a chance and record demos with her, the band is assembled, includes Phil Taylor of Motorhead, which must have came with a lifetime supply of methamphetamine, to be honest. But after those demos prove potential, it's time to find a permanent band to help her make the music really happen. And that's where she forms the Pretenders with Pete Farndon, James Honeyman Scott, and Martin Chambers.
James Honeyman Scott. That is a typo in the script, and I will take credit for that.
Honeyman, take it for Honeyman.
So James Honeyman Scott, quite a guy. Let's just say this. If you have not read the Chrissy Hynde book that she wrote about her life, it is unbelievable. Have you read it?
No, never read it. I remember when you did.
Oh, yeah. You remember what I did because I kept texting you, probably being like, holy shit. So Chrissy's like this figure out of a Greek or biblical tragedy, right? She fights and fights to gain the success she wants. And when she finally starts to get it with this band, the drugs destroy them. And I mean, in quick, percussive manner. 82, June, they kick out Farndon. They have a band meeting and they kick out Farndon because of his drug habit. Bro, too many drugs. 2 days later, Honeyman Scott dies from cocaine. 2 days after kicking out another guy. Talk about, you know, the pot and the kettle. And then the guy that they kicked out, he will die. I mean, they were right. He had a problem.
Within a year. Yeah.
And it's in the wake of this. It's after this happens that this Learning to Crawl record is created. And it's funny because Chrissy will claim that the title has nothing to do with what she was doing in the aftermath of any of this. It was more about her daughter learning to crawl. And I'm like, stop it. Stop coming up with the most practical reason to name that record. Just let the artistic flair lay, okay? What are you doing?
Brian, let the baby crawl. Since you have this, you know, this fluidity with the members of the group, it makes it unique because different pieces of the record recorded with different people.
Mm-hmm.
Within this music community that swirls around Chrissy, and that includes members of Rockpile, Squeeze, and Graham Parker's band. So serious heavy hitters in the studio with her.
Now, to this song specifically that brings us here, all those punk bands that I mentioned earlier with which Chrissy had some involvement, they are British, if you might have noticed that. Chrissy is from Akron, Ohio. She moves to London as a teenager. And My City Was Gone is about Akron. And it's a song about coming back to your hometown after partying with punk rockers in London and being like, man, this town sucks. This is gone to shit.
And I don't know what you know about Akron, but this is a city who at its most prosperous is built on, you know, rubber tire money, basically. Goodyear is there. And when I say Goodyear's there, they literally build neighborhoods to house their employees. Oh, wow. Goodyear was there. So it's not an exaggeration to say that its prosperity is driven by the emergence of the automobile.
Yeah, and this causes it to become industrial, right? And so for some of the wild and beautiful parts of this town, this emergence of the auto industry takes a toll on it. And so this is a lyric from the song. Quote, "I went back to Ohio, but my pretty countryside had been paved down the middle by a government that had no pride."
But its lyrical POV is not what causes a young radio broadcaster to use it as the beginning of his talk show.
It is not. No, the song is a B-side to Back in the Chain Gang in 82. But they officially released it on Learning to Crawl in 84. And it's that same year that Rush gets a hold of this. And he has just landed a show in Sacramento, California.
And like a lot of radio guys, Brian and I can attest to this, Rush got fired a lot in his early days, so much that he actually quit radio. And I don't know if anybody knew this. He worked Major League Baseball for a while, but he goes back on the air in Kansas City briefly in the 80s, and he lands a spot in California before he gets back into syndication and all that stuff happens.
And when he's looking for a good song to play at the start of the show, he recognizes that the bass line in My City Was Gone is perfect.
So he should have asked permission.
Yeah,
uh-huh. We won't get into the technical laws at the time around copyright and what radio did and didn't have to do, but he should have asked. But as his profile rises and people bring up to Chrissy that this guy who is gaining notoriety on the radio is using her song, she doesn't care because her dad is a fan of Rush.
Which is funny. I mean, I feel better about my dad being a fan of Rush and about you having once been a fan of Rush.
I bought a book. I didn't say I was a fan. And you got a Glenn Beck book.
I don't think I paid for the Glenn Beck book, but I do think it came to the AM talk radio station I worked around at the time, and I do think it was autographed. I've since burned it. So the here's the deal. If you followed Rush's career, you know something happens. So he starts as like a radio guy. And I don't know if a lot of people know this. I'm curious if you know this. So Rush, if you do the research, even if you don't do the research, you know that he ushers in this wave of political media. There's a reason that he's able to do that. Up until the middle of the Reagan administration, there was a law that and a way the FCC controlled things that kept radical views from being espoused on airwaves without a counterpoint. So if you were going to say something that was, let's just say you were going to say like, the election was stolen from me. Like somebody would then immediately have to come on after you and be like, well, here's why we would say that the election was not stolen from you, right? You couldn't just run rampant with one opinion. In, I think it's like 86, the FCC decides to get rid of this. They take that rule off the books. And very quickly...
And other rules, by the way.
Very quickly, it is realized that you can build an audience by trying to rile people up. Imagine that. And so Rush starts... Like, I think he sort of happens into it. Like, there's a political opinion he has that he mentions, and people get sort of upset about it. And then all of a sudden, he realizes, oh, this is, like, working. Like, wouldn't it be great if I never got fired from radio again, since I've already left this career once? And so he gets himself into this place and pattern where he keeps having to up the ante. He has to be more and more controversial because that's what he becomes known for. And so when he is at his most obnoxious in the mid-90s, he runs his mouth one day when the song comes up. Somebody mentions or talks about the song at the beginning of the show, right? And he says the following. "I like playing My City Was Gone because it was written by an environmentalist animal rights wacko, and it was an anti-conservative song. It is anti-development, anti-capitalist, and here I am going to take a liberal song and make fun of them at the same time."
So then Chrissy's forced to play ball, so she sends a C&D, which, if you don't know, is a cease and desist, and Rush has to stop playing it.
Which is hilarious, because for all this time, he's gotten away with it for literally like whatever that is, 15 years or something, right? And then Chrissy realizes something. She realizes she has a chance to win at this game in a bigger way. And again, like if you read her book, Chrissy ain't dumb. Chrissy's very smart and always been not scared. I mean, dude, she was hanging out with Malcolm McLaren and Sid Vicious, right? So she knows how to mess with people and how to stand her ground. She just decides that if she takes somebody who is being a provocateur and calls them on the carpet, they're not going to be able to back down by virtue of what they're trying to do. So she calls his bluff. He had said actually around this time that he agreed that the EPA shouldn't be testing chemicals on animals. He made some comment about that. And she latches onto it. That she's like, finds the one thing they agree on. And she comes out with an offer. And she says, in light of Rush Limbaugh's vocal support of PETA's campaign against the Environmental Protection Agency's foolish plans to test 3,000 chemicals on animals, I've decided to allow him to keep my song, My City Was Gone, as his signature tune, if he will donate all proceeds from the deal to further PETA's efforts in that regard. So
yes.
This becomes the story of that time Rush Limbaugh donated $100,000 to PETA because Chrissy Hynde made him.
Yeah. And yeah, so to wrap up, yeah, there's a Pretender song that was at the front of that guy's radio show.
Oh,
if
man.
You didn't know.
Unbelievable. Have you ever seen The Pretenders?
I have not seen The Pretenders, no.
I saw them do a theater tour in 20, I want to say it was pre-COVID, so maybe 2018, 2019. And man, they still, you know, it's just Chrissy really now, but it unbelievable. If you want to get involved with the show, if you have a question, if you have something you've always wondered about a song you liked or didn't like so much, send it to us. It's wearethestoryguys@gmail.com. And remember, you can come hang out, since we're talking about cities, come hang out in our city. It's Louder Than Life Music Festival. It happens, oh man, September's going to be here faster than you think, and it's your chance to see everybody from Korn to Slayer to Tom Morello and I don't know, something like 150 other bands. Check out in the show notes, you'll find the links and all of the details about that music festival. And if you want to win 4-day passes for you and a friend, well, you just have to send us an email back to that address. It's wearethestoryguys@gmail.com. Tell us about your best music festival experience, favorite music festival experience, something crazy that happened to you at a music fest, and you could be going to the show. It's that simple. So, Murdoch, until next time, what should people keep doing?
Keep telling stories.
Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories is a Story Guys production. The show is produced and edited by Brian Eichenberger. Get more stories, hear more podcasts, and book the guys for your conference or house party at wearethestoryguys.com. Copyright Boy Have We Got Stories Productions. All rights reserved.